Welcome to NC State's Audio Abstract. I'm your host, Tracy Peek. On this Halloween-adjacent episode, we're going to focus, zombie-like, on the brain. Specifically, we're going to talk about some different conditions that can occur when the brain's normal function gets disrupted in some way. We're speaking with two researchers in Professor John Meitzen's lab, graduate student Jamie Willett and postdoctoral research fellow Amanda Krentzel. Welcome. How are you?
Doing well, yeah. Thank you for having us.
First of all, Jamie, how did you get interested in the brain and brain research?
Well, my undergraduate degree was in psychology, and I was really interested in understanding the mechanisms that underlie behavior. And in order to study that, I came to NC State in order to join a neurophysiology lab and study the nitty-gritty of how the brain works.
And Amanda, how about you?
So I actually majored in neuroscience at Centenary College of Louisiana. That's where I grew up, in Shreveport, Louisiana. And I knew I wanted to be a neuroscience major really early because I was interested in behavior and I had gotten interested in things like psychiatry and stuff. But then when I took a biology course at the end of high school, I realized I really liked studying this from the perspective of biology. And so neuroscience was kind of the perfect blend of psychology and biology.
But in both cases, you're also studying not just the psychological aspects of it, but actual structural neurology and neurobiology. I believe you have five different interesting topics to share with us today. So let's get started. I believe we're going to start with a gentleman some people may have heard of named Phineas Gage, who's probably one of the most famous case studies in terms of brain physiology that we have to date. If you want to talk to me a little bit about that, that'd be great.
Yeah, Phineas Gage is commonly taught in every intro neurobiology course, intro psychology course. I have learned his case very frequently and often, but not everyone knows about him unless they took those courses. And so he was a 25-year-old railroad worker in Cavendish, Vermont, and he was working on putting in a new rail line there. And what they would do in order to blow up rocks to clear the way for the new trail is they would place charge, and then they would pack sand on top of the charge, and they would use something called a tamping iron. And so this is a 3 foot and 7 inches long, large iron rod, basically, that they would use to pack down the sand on top of the charge. And so he got distracted or something, but he forgot to put the sand down and he put the tamping iron down and ignited the charge. And so this caused this huge tamping iron to get blown back out at him. And it basically went through his left cheek and behind his eye socket and then out of the top of his head. And it landed 20 to 25 yards behind him. So it went straight through his left frontal lobe. He was able to survive this, but he was not the same afterward. And his friends described him as no longer Gage because his personality changed dramatically. So he survived this, but he wasn't the same. And his treating physician described him as fitful, irreverent, indulging at times in the grossest profanity, which was not previously his custom. So he experienced this dramatic change in personality. And at the time, it's the 1800s, and it's still the days of phrenology, which was when they would measure the bumps on your skull in order to determine what your personality was. And so this was the first case where you had damage to a specific brain region and a distinct change in personality resulted. And so it was the first case of understanding how damage to one localized part of the brain could change behavior.
Now, with our more modern understanding of the different portions and areas of the brain and what they may affect, have people subsequently kind of figured out exactly kind of what he took out, or actually what that rod took out or interfered with?
Yeah, so it's been revisited a handful of times with new technology that they can use to image the brain and reconstruct what this type of injury must have looked like in the brain. And so that's how they've localized it to this left frontal lobe. And also they've used his skull, which is actually on display along with the tamping iron at the Warren Anatomical Museum in Boston. So I went to visit it recently over the summer. And I mean, this tamping iron is huge. And the skull has healed over a bit, but you can still see where the hole was. And it's right over where the frontal lobe, or this left part of the prefrontal cortex is, which we now know to be very important for these personality traits, and as well as planning and decision making. And what a lot of people don't know about him is that his personality change probably only lasted for about 2 to 3 years. And that it likely wasn't permanent because the brain is so plastic. And so he lived for 12 more years after this incident occurred, and he had a slew of jobs, and he eventually became a long distance stagecoach driver. And so he can't have had two damaged faculties of decision making and planning to be able to do that. So it is thought that it was a temporary change.
I knew that he had survived having basically a rod go through his brain. I did not know that the resulting damage kind of resolved.
Because that's the part of the brain that, when lobotomies used to happen, would get scrambled. And that caused very permanent damage long term. So it's very interesting that he seemed to recover.
I also read that he would carry that tamping iron with him everywhere that he went after this incident. And there's a picture of him at this museum where you can see his skull. And he's got his tamping iron in his arm.
Like his security blanket.
Yeah.
Here I am. I'm Phineas Gage, and this went through my head. Amanda, what do you have for us?
You know, Phineas Gage suffered an accident, but sometimes damage to the brain can be intentional as a treatment for certain people. So the case I wanted to talk about is this phenomenon known as split brain. People who have split brain are typically those who have epilepsy that's untreatable by medications, and this is sort of a last resort effort at making it so that their seizures are less violent and less frequent. And so what they do is there's a part of the brain called the corpus callosum, and what that is are long fiber tracts that connect the left and the right hemispheres. When you think of a neuron, this is the long axons that are communicating one side of the brain to the other side of the brain. And so if you're having a seizure, essentially what that is so much activity of the brain that it becomes unmanageable, and it causes things like convulsions or uncontrollable movements, and it actually can be quite damaging. And so what they do is they will make incision, and they'll cut the corpus callosum in order to stop this communication to prevent the seizures from jumping from one hemisphere to the other hemisphere. And so some people will have just a small cut, but others, especially with very severe cases, will have a complete dissection of the corpus callosum. So it's going to be completely severed between the two hemispheres.
And so you basically would have both sides of your brain just operating independently of one another at the same time?
Exactly. Okay. It's kind of talked about as having two brains in one head, because they're no longer able to communicate between each other. And what's important to know about the brain is that a lot of functions, like sensory functions, like your vision, things that you're feeling, they are sent to one side or the other based on what side of the body that's coming from. It's usually crossed. So for example, things in your left field of vision come in through your eyes and they cross over to the right side of your brain. And then the reverse happens for the right side of vision into the left side of the brain. Now, what's important to know about this kind of dissection is that vision and that crossing over stays intact, because it's not a part of the corpus callosum how that crosses over, but almost everything else is. And so what you'll see in these people is, like, you can present an image. Let's say you're presenting it on their left side, so it goes to their right side of their brain. And so their visual cortex will get that information. However, if you tell them to tell you what they've seen, they can't. And the reason for that is because the language centers of the brain for most people are almost exclusively on the left side of the brain. So the right brain sees the image, but the left brain isn't having access to that. And so the person can't express what they've seen, even though they definitely see it.
And what happens if you switch the image and you show it to them on the right side? Can they then describe what they're looking at?
Exactly. If you show them on the right side, it'll go to their left hemisphere. And because that visual cortex on the left side gets that information, it can, within that hemisphere, now communicate to those language centers. It just couldn't cross over to the right side because that corpus callosum has been cut.
Okay, so that's one way in which folks are affected with split brain syndrome, but what other issues might someone have?
Yeah, I gave the example of language. We refer to it as being lateralized, meaning it's on one side. There are other functions of the brain that aren't necessarily divided between the two hemispheres. There was this patient known as patient JW. So often in a lot of these case studies, the patients will be anonymous, so they'll just be referred to as their initials. And with patient JW, he had a total dissection of the corpus callosum, and they did a scientific study in which they presented basic arithmetic problems, either to one visual field or the other visual field. And by doing this, by only presenting it to one or the other, they were able to determine which side of the brain was essentially better at doing basic arithmetic or doing these calculations. And so what they found is actually the left hemisphere is the one that's doing those calculations as opposed to the right hemisphere. And the same thing is true for self-recognition. So they would show pictures of either himself or the researcher, and they also found that the left side of the brain was better than chance at saying, oh, that's me versus that's you. That kind of gets into like how you recognize oneself, like an image of yourself. And that's kind of interesting to think that you would show the right brain an image of yourself, and that's you, but you can't recognize you because it's the right brain and not the left brain.
That's interesting. It sounds like the left brain is really busy.
It is really busy. And it has a lot to do with hand dominance. People who are right-handed tend to have a very left-dominant brain. But if you're not right-handed, there's actually quite a lot of division between the two hemispheres. They're sharing a lot of those functions between each other.
That's fascinating. So what do we have up next?
My case follows rather nicely from Amanda's, and it involves a syndrome, I suppose, that's called prosopagnosia. Also known as face blindness. As she mentioned, not being able to recognize you, this is a case where people are unable to recognize faces at all. It can range on what you're unable to discriminate between. If you have this prosopagnosia or face blindness, so you may not be able to discriminate between familiar faces. You may not be able to discriminate between unknown faces or distinguish that a face is different from an object, or you might not be able to recognize your own face. To give an example, Oliver Sacks, who is a very famous physician and neurologist who passed away a couple of years ago, was famously face blind. And he wrote an essay for The New Yorker, which I'm going to read from, where he discusses his own experience being face blind. This is from him. He says, I have had difficulty recognizing faces for as long as I can remember. I did not think too much about this as a child, but by the time I was a teenager in a new school, it was often a cause of embarrassment. My frequent inability to recognize schoolmates would cause bewilderment and sometimes offense. It did not occur to them, and why should it, that I had a perceptual problem. I usually recognized close friends without much difficulty, especially my two best friends, Eric Korn and Jonathan Miller, but this was partly because I identified particular features. And so this is how people with face blindness will compensate. He recognized Eric had heavy eyebrows and thick spectacles. And so he would know, oh, you're Eric because I see your heavy eyebrows and these distinguishing features that he could latch onto. And Jonathan was tall and gangly with a mop of red hair.
So he didn't even have to look at his face. He could just be right. Like, tall guy, red hair.
Tall guy, red hair, got it. He goes on to say that at the age of 77, Despite a lifetime of trying to compensate, he has no less trouble with faces and places. He's particularly thrown if he sees people out of context. It's this very interesting thing that can happen, the difference between sensation and perception, where you can sense something, but your brain puts it together and interprets it in a way that you're not aware of. Because until reading about this, it never occurred to me that my brain was doing anything with interpreting faces.
Right.
Until I understood what it was like for someone who can't do that.
So they would just see parts.
And what's interesting is, so there's also another case of this. There's an artist named Chuck Close. And if you look up his work, he does these really, really amazing portraits where he can paint a face and it looks like a photograph. And he's also a photographer, and he'll put the small photographs together to make a face, because to him, it's like a landscape. It's just a really beautiful way that he's taken his face blindness and turned it into something really awesome.
Have they done any research about like what portion of the brain is affected by this this particular condition?
The portion of the brain is the right fusiform gyrus.
Wow.
So a gyrus is basically a ridge of the brain. If you've ever, seen a picture of a brain, you'll notice that it looks like it has these wrinkles in it. And so each of those wrinkles is called a gyrus. This is one of those gyri, is how they're called when they're multiple gyri. but this gyrus is in the ventral temporal cortex, which ventral means under, so it's towards the bottom of the brain. And so temporal is like the bottom side, basically. And so this is on the right side, and it's one of those ridges that they have found to be very important for facial perception.
In kind of the same vein as perceptual deficits, there's this condition that's called hemifield neglect. Usually this presents in individuals who have suffered either a stroke or some other kind of injury that happens to one side of the brain. Almost everyone that presents with hemifield neglect has had injury to the right side of the brain. And the reason for that is the right side of the brain is actually very important for processing spatial representation. And this occurs sort of around the parietal lobe of the cortex. And so when, say, for example, someone has suffered a stroke and they've had a lot of cell death and damage to the right hemisphere of the brain, what you can see and how we diagnose hemifield neglect is that they will then ignore the left side of their body. So it's not that they can't see, because their visual cortex is fine. It's that they're not perceiving that part of themselves. And they'll also ignore the left field of space. If they look at a picture and you tell them, all right, draw this picture for me exactly how you see it, they'll only draw the right side of the picture. Or for their own body, they will shave their face, but only shave the right side of their face and not the left. Or they'll not notice that their clothes aren't fitting right on their left side. And sometimes, in very severe cases, they'll even deny that the left side of their body belongs to them. So they'll, like, their arm will be there and they'll just say, oh, that's not mine. It's a perceptual issue. If they like turn their head and they look, they can see it. But in general, they're not very motivated to notice or look at that part of space, essentially, is the left side of space.
Damage on the right side means you're not perceiving accurately what's going on the left side, even though you can see it. I'm glad to know that the right side of our brain is as busy as the left side that we discussed earlier. So that's good to know.
Yes, it's doing things.
It's doing things. And that's fascinating. So with most of these syndromes or conditions that people have, some of them are due to physical injury. Can you come back from physical injury? Is that different from if you're just born with face blindness? There's nothing that we can really, there's no therapy, there's nothing that you can really do to help people correct for that. They just kind of have to compensate.
The brain can compensate very well. Like I said before, it's very plastic, which means that it can change in response to injury in order to take over whatever functions have been lost. But that's not always possible. Like, you have the case of Phineas, who was able to recover to a certain extent, whereas patients who were lobotomized were not.
And it also has a lot to do with how old someone is when injury happens. So it's very well documented that very young people, like children, either who maybe get their corpus callosum cut or they have injury to the brain somehow, can actually develop more function along the way than someone that this happens to later in life. And that has a lot to do with how plastic the brain is so young in life. Because if you imagine, as a person is developing, it makes a lot of sense to have the brain be very malleable because you're learning a lot of new skills. You're trying to get better at things in order to become successful as an adult. And having the brain be very plastic at that moment of development is really advantageous. So for like hemifield neglect, a lot of these people, because it happens from stroke, are much, much older. But they do have things like occupational therapists will work with them to try and, since it's an issue of perception and attention, they will try and force them to divert their attention to the left. Or they'll maybe bind their right arm so that they're forced to use their left arm and pay attention to what's going on the left side of their body because they can't use their right arm for this task. And so that's like one way you can use like training and learning in order to help the brain recover some functions.
So it can sort of rewire itself.
Exactly.
So now we've talked a little bit about the difference between perception and sensation, right? So when you perceive something, your brain actually has to get the signal, figure out what the signal is, and then tell you what it is so that you can understand the world around you. So I believe the last topic we were going to talk about has to do specifically with sensation, mm-hmm. right? And sensation for limbs that may no longer be there.
Yeah, this is referred to as phantom limb. Phantom limb, it's very interesting because it actually happens to any part of the body that you can lose. So it's not just your limbs. It can be your eye. It can be a tooth. People, basically, when a part of the body, which, you know, all of our peripheral parts, our arms, our legs, our eyes, our teeth, they have nerves that connect to them. And then those send connections to the spinal cord, which then go up to the brain. And so just because that body part isn't there anymore doesn't mean the nerves that are projecting to that body part aren't there. They still exist. And so for what people experience is they can experience not unpleasant sensations, but what's really debilitating is they'll experience like pain. And it's pain, like, so for example, if someone has an arm amputated, they may sense that their arm is still there and they might feel like their hand is clenched all the time. And it creates this feeling of just really immense pain that won't go away. And since they don't actually have an arm, they can't unclench their fist. There's a lot of theories behind why this happens. So for a long time, neuroscientists thought it was because of like inflammation. Oh, so you've lost that limb and those nerves are inflamed. But that doesn't seem to be the case because they can't really treat it very well with pain medication or targeting inflammation. The other hypothesis is that actually kind of what we were talking about the brain being plastic, is actually what's happening is the brain, because that limb is no longer there anymore, is rewiring what part of the brain used to sense that part of the body. And so there's, you know, this part of the brain called the sensory cortex, and it actually has a map of the entire body mapped out. There's more representation of certain parts of your body than others. So for example, the face and the mouth has a lot of brain space dedicated to it. What you can see actually is for some people with phantom limb, if you will stroke their face, they'll actually feel it in their phantom limb. And that kind of indicates that that part of the body is sort of taking over those nerves. And so they're getting this weird mixed signal between where their limb nerves and then their face nerves and how that's actually mapped in the sensory cortex of the brain. It's definitely like kind of getting into the sensation part of the brain, but it's also a part of perception as well, because perception areas of the brain and sensation areas of the brain are very interconnected with each other.
Okay, first of all, I was unaware that you could ever have a phantom tooth pain. That's amazing. And Secondly, how long does this does it persist forever? Or does it eventually get to a point where the signals stop being crossed, your brain kind of figures out, okay, here's what needs to be wired this way, and then you're okay again?
What I've seen from reading up about this topic more is that it is very severe at the very beginning that a limb is lost, but over time, symptoms can go away and maybe episodes of pain get further and further between. But some people definitely can experience this for the rest of their life, but maybe the severity and how often they experience the phantom limb goes away over time. But it's definitely concerning enough that neurologists are trying very hard to find a way to treat this because pain is so hard to deal with and debilitating for a lot of people. And when you're experiencing pain in something that doesn't actually exist, that you can't target that arm that's giving you pain, that's a really complicated problem. One way that's a very interesting way to treat this is this thing called the mirror box. And this was actually designed by a neurologist known as V.S. Ramachandran. And he's getting into this idea I talked about perception and sensation being really interconnected with each other in the brain. So what he does for, like, example, if we talk about someone who's lost an arm, the mirror box is something where you will put both of your arms in and the arm that you have is going to be reflected to the other side of your body. And so when you look down at your hands, you're perceiving your hands, it looks like now you have two hands and you have two arms. And so for a person who maybe has that clenched fist feeling all the time, they will just unclench their fist and they see it happening on the side of their body where their phantom limb is, and their pain goes away. They feel that sensation of their fist unclenching. Now, the issue is that this is temporary. You can't have your arms in a mirror box forever, but they do try to work with patients in like an occupational therapy session to like do this over and over again and sort of try and train them that feeling of how they're relieving that pain. There's no pharmaceuticals or whatever involved. It's just relying on your own perception of your body.
And letting that wiring work, right?
Yeah.
Well, let's leave with a question for both of you. What do you individually find to be the most fascinating thing about the human brain?
I guess what I find to be the most fascinating thing is that your brain is who you are. Who you are is all in this one organ. It can be kind of scary at times to think that it's all right there, but also really amazing. And the brain is just so powerful in what it's capable of and so diverse and different in how it can function, but it is who you are.
For me, it's sort of about how much your brain can change. When we think about neurons, which are ultimately what makes up the brain, and they communicate to give you all these thoughts and feelings, they, despite living a long time, and they seem as almost they're stable because those cells themselves can exist from the time you're born until the time you die, but they're so capable of changing their connections all the time based on what you're getting from your environment that your brain is always changing. So your brain is definitely who you are, but you can change who you are because of the way your brain works. It's not set up to just be static. It's always changing. So I think that's what I think is the most fascinating part of the brain.
Okay, well, wonderful. Well, thank you both very much for being here today. We have been speaking with graduate student Jamie Willett and postdoctoral research fellow Amanda Krenzel from the lab of John Meitzen here at NC State. Thank you so much for listening to Audio Abstract. I'm Tracy Peake.